going to have more pollution, you're going to have destruction of fisheries, you're going to impoverish the people, you're going to poison the people with all the toxic elements coming from the refinery. And then moreover, the country is going to say, well, we have all this oil, why should we move to renewable energy?
Contrary to expectations that the signing of the Petroleum Industry Act would automatically lead to the removal of fuel subsidy, the federal government of Nigeria says the subsidy will remain until a feasible framework is developed.
The PIB has actually deregulated the sector, but that doesn't mean that there will be an immediate implementation of that price hike, of that of the deregulation. What the PIB provides is that products will be sold at market dictated prices. So it will not be shouldered by, it will be shouldered by all of us. This is the only fund that is targeted at the host communities in this country. Because all other such funds were not really targeted at the host community. You have the 13% derivation, which was also instituted to douse this problem. And many times, this 13% is not targeted at the host communities. So the 13% may be spent somewhere, and the problem is happening somewhere else.
Of course, most Nigerians are opposed to removal of the fuel subsidy, saying it will push up inflation.
To address some of the controversial details of the new law, our correspondent Folashade Ogunrinde tells us more.
Since President Muhammadu Buhari signed the much-talked-about Petroleum Industry Bill into law, one of the most prominent concerns it has raised is whether or not the pump price of petrol will go up for as high as 300 naira per litre. Usually, the impact of fuel price hike is felt first in the public transportation system, where bus operators jack up fares and commuters pay more.
In every way, the party driver or every transport company will have to increase the price of or the tariff at which they take to wherever it is that they are going to.
Looking at it, in the other hand, when I buy fuel at the rate of 300 and something naira, I'm likely to increase the transport fare so that I can meet up to go and come and buy the fuel again and go back.
It's going to affect a lot. Not only transportation will affect, it will affect even people selling foodstuff. It will affect anything that affects transport, that affects fuel, will affect every other thing.
For a standard living in a common man in Nigeria now, how can you buy fuel for 360 naira and you are receiving a minimum wage of 30,000 naira? Logic, how does that gel? It doesn't work.
The government has decided to maintain the petrol subsidy contrary to expectations. Now, what's your take on this decision?
You know, the question of oil subsidy is one thing that is so opaque that Nigerians don't understand what the subsidy is and where the subsidy comes from. Many times they've told us they've stopped paying subsidies, but then we find that they're still paying subsidies. So it's like there's something political beneath the subsidy argument. And if you ask me, the actual subsidy we have in the oil sector, the petroleum sector, is a subsidy provided by the environment that is being trashed, subsidy provided by the communities who are being polluted and contaminated, whose livelihoods are destroyed. And so we just hope that government will wake up one day and tell us exactly how much does the petrol imported or produced locally cost, and how much are we paying at the pump price, and stop playing politics with subsidies.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nimo Basay, for your insight on the new petroleum law in Nigeria. Let's take a short break now, and when we come back, we shall talk about global fashion brands polluting African rivers. Stay with us.
Global fashion brands polluting African rivers.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Now, a new report shows that production of clothing, including for high street brands in Europe and the US, is killing Africa's rivers through polluting discharges of untreated industrial water. Now, the report by Water Witness International showcased the polluted rivers in Lesotho in Southern Africa and Tanzania to highlight the risks posed by global brands increasingly sourcing clothing from entrepreneurs in Africa, attracted by cheap labor and tax incentives.
Nick Hepworth, Water Witness International manager and author of the report, identified around 50 international brands that source or have purchased their clothes in African countries, including Zara from Inditex, ASOS and H&M. One of the rivers affected by untreated wastewater from factories producing garments for global brands is the Simbazi River that flows across Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Now, for an incisive analysis on how global fashion brands are involved directly or indirectly in polluting African water bodies in general and rivers in particular, we have contacted Dr. Nick Hepworth, the Water Witness International manager who authored the damning report. Thanks for joining us. Now, can you first tell us why these global brands prefer producing their products in African countries?
Sure. Africa still has just a fraction of the global trade with the fashion market, and it's shadowed by the big producers in Asia. But it's a really important potential driver of job creation and economic growth in Africa. For example, before the pandemic, selling clothes to the global fashion brands was worth about $4.6 billion a year to the African continent. And producers are drawn there by a combination of cheap labor costs and overheads, probably the cheapest labor on the planet, and tax incentives from national governments keen to grow the sector, and favorable trade deals that have emerged over the past few years, which relieve duty on imports from Africa to the US and Europe.
Well, quite unfortunate there that cheap African labor is a major incentive for global fashion brands producing their products in Africa, and I guess that will qualify for modern slavery or neo-slavery.
The European Union has a comprehensive liability regime for damages to the environment based on the polluter pays principle. This legislation has pushed out manufacturers that disregard protection of the environment, forcing them to relocate to third world countries where there are less stringent laws. Why are these fashion brands disregarding the protection of the environment of African countries while they would not dare do the same in Western countries?
Well, many of the fashion brands are outsourcing production to middlemen, to factories which are largely owned by Asian companies across Africa. And again, they play a really important role in generating employment and export revenue. But the brands are also outsourcing pollution and impacts on water, because the regulatory controls that are in place are very weak or not enforced. And so by not enforcing strict standards on their suppliers, the brands are turning a blind eye on the pollution that their production and their supply chains are creating. National governments are often feel as though their hands are tied. They're reluctant to enforce pollution control on factories that employ thousands of people, because they fear that the production will simply shift next door.
The United States and the European Union have established programs which give African countries duty-free access to their consumer markets. In a bid to create employment for thousands of their citizens, most of these African countries rush to set up factories with little regard for the environment. The governments of the EU and the US pushed for agreements to produce these garments in Africa. Are they complicit in the destruction of the environment by these global fashion brands?
Absolutely. Just to that point, you know, it's really important, particularly given COVID and the climate emergency, that we do all we can to ensure that everybody has access to safe water, sanitation and hygiene, and is protected from droughts and floods. And the global supply chains and companies and brands producing in Africa have an important role to play. Certainly the governments that have negotiated improved trade deals have an important role to play to ensure that the companies the supply chains and the financiers behind this sector in Africa are compelled to comply with pollution control law and ethical standards of production. And they can do that in a number of ways, attaching a disclosure of good performance to the export and import licenses, for example, and enabling companies to be prosecuted and sanctioned for abuse of human rights and water, no matter where they work in the world.
A government can play a critical role if there is political will to implement tough environmental laws that will compel manufacturers to implement good manufacturing practices friendly to the ecosystem. Citizens have the right to water, and factories must be cognizant of this fact. An activist in Tanzania speaks here on the need to protect water from pollution.
Sote tuna haki ya maji safi na salama kwa matumizi ya binadamu na uhai. Tuna wajibu kuhakikisha vyanzo vyetu vya maji havichafuliwi.
Now, what should governments of consumer countries do to ensure that factories producing garments for these global fashion brands do not destroy the environment?
Well, we need to see strong and immediate political leadership to draft and enforce legislation which requires companies to meet basic standards of social justice and environmental protection throughout their supply chains. And also a requirement on the financiers and investments and the banks behind those companies to disclose performance and to divest from companies that continue to abuse water and local communities.
Now, consumers are gradually becoming more engaged in sustainability topics. Many now are demanding that fashion players uphold their social and environmental responsibilities. Now, what's the role of consumers in ensuring that the products they use are compliant to the protection of the environment?
That's a great question. You know, whether we like it or not, the global markets have a huge influence on the way we use the planet's resources and on communities across the planet. There's a really important role for consumers because markets respond to consumer demand. So we need consumers to step up to ask questions and demand the responsible use of water in the production of the food, of the clothes, of the computers that they consume. That's what's going to drive change, and that needs to happen and happen quickly.
Well, yes, indeed. There is need for urgent action to be taken to stop the pollution of African waters by global fashion brands. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you watching, and please do send us your comments through our social media handle. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, US researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled "Boys More at Risk from Pfizer Jab Side Effect Than COVID, Suggests Study." Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, American researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. Most children who experienced the rare side effect had symptoms within days of the second shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, though a similar side effect is seen with the Moderna jab as well. About 86% of the boys affected required some hospital care, the author said. Saul Faust, professor of pediatric immunology and infectious diseases at the University of Southampton in England, who was not involved in the work, said the findings appear to justify the cautious approach taken on teenage vaccines by the British government's Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, JCVI. The Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, JCVI, did not recommend vaccinating healthy 12 to 15-year-olds, but referred the matter to the UK's chief medical officers, who are expected to make a final decision next week. Children aged 12 to 15 who are particularly vulnerable to COVID or who live with an at-risk person are eligible for the vaccine shots. In the latest study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, Dr. Tracy Hoag at the University of California and colleagues analyzed adverse reactions to COVID vaccines in U.S. children aged 12 to 17 during the first 6 months of 2021. They estimate the rate of myocarditis after 2 shots of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to be 162.2 cases per million for healthy boys aged between 12 and 15, and 94 cases per million for healthy boys aged 16 and 17. The equivalent rates for girls were 13.4 and 13 cases per million, respectively. At current U.S. infection rates, the risk of a healthy adolescent being taken to hospital with COVID in the next 120 days is about 44 per million, they said. How reliable the data is and whether similar numbers could be seen in the United Kingdom if healthy 12 to 15-year-olds are vaccinated are unclear. Vaccine reactions are recorded differently in the United States, and vaccine shots are given at longer time intervals in the United Kingdom. According to the UK medicines regulator, the rate of myocarditis after COVID vaccination is only 6 per million shots of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. So far, British children have not been admitted to hospital for COVID in large numbers and may not be at risk of long COVID. While the recent CLOCK study found that up to 14% of children who caught COVID may still have symptoms 15 weeks later, levels of fatigue appear similar to those in children who have not caught the virus. This suggests that children may be spared some of the most debilitating problems seen in adult long COVID. The overwhelming majority of myocarditis appears after the second dose of the vaccine, so offering single shots of the vaccine could protect children while reducing their risk of the side effect even further. While myocarditis after vaccination is exceptionally rare, we may be able to change the first or second doses or combine vaccines differently to avoid the risk at all, once we understand the physiology better, said Professor Faust. On balance, there is no urgency to immunize children from a medical perspective, although if schools are unable to maintain education for the vast majority at all times, the overall balance could shift. If my two teenage children are offered the vaccine by the NHS, my GP wife and I will have no hesitation in allowing them to receive the vaccine. Professor Adam Finn, a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization at the University of Bristol, said, "I stand by the Joint Committee on Vaccine and Immunization advice, which is not to go ahead at this time with vaccinating healthy 12 to 15-year-olds on health outcome risk-benefit grounds, given the current uncertainty. As there is a small but plausible risk that rare harms could turn out to outweigh modest benefits."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Today's lesson: why is debt bad? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Well, what exactly is wrong with having a little or a lot of debt? To start with, here are some of the problems debt can cause in your life. We've already gone over four of them. The fifth one is debt keeps you from reaching your financial goals. Monthly debt payments limit the amount of money you have to spend on other things, not just retirement, but the trip you always wanted to take or Eid gifts for your family. The more debt you accumulate, the more your monthly payments will be, and the less you have to spend on everything else. Number six, stress and serious medical problems. When you have debt, it's hard not to worry about how you are going to make your payments or how you will keep from taking on more debt to make ends meet. The stress from debt can lead to mild to severe health problems, including ulcers, migraines, depression, and even heart attacks. The deeper you get into debt, the more likely it is that you will face health complications. And at the end of the day, why were we buying all this stuff for? So we could potentially stay happy, right? Well, guess what? If you lose your health, happiness goes down the drain. That's the last thing on your mind then. Because health is that blessing that you want to protect. And getting into this debt-based, mortgage-based, interest-based system, it takes away not just the happiness, but even your health from you. You get into depression, and then it has consequences which we will talk over.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing why debt is bad. We have already gone over six serious issues with debt-based lifestyle. A lifestyle where you pay debt and you pay interest. When you take debt, when you take loan and pay interest over it. Last but not the least, for this series of issues with debt-based models and why debt is bad is that debt can hurt your marriage and your relationships. Brothers and sisters, debt puts unnecessary pressure on the household's finances and creates a lack of financial security for your spouse and your children. When both partners feel overwhelmed, it can spark arguments over spending habits. Who is creating more debt? And how much debt is too much? What is the definition of too much debt? So there are disagreements between spouses over that then. And then, oh, you bought this, that's why we're stuck now, we have to pay all this money and this interest because you made that purchase. And then, you know, the counterpart says, no, because of the car you bought, we got into this situation. If you would have gotten a simpler car, so on and so forth. You know how those arguments go on. These fights can escalate and lead to a breakdown in marriage. And we have seen many examples of this. If you look around, even in your relatives, your friends, your contacts, your peers, your coworkers, if you dig down into what problems they went through, rest assured, one of the problems in most of the cases, maybe not all, but most of the cases is that the debt the family had to pay for and the interest money was way too high. So again, the list of seven bad things about debt are: debt encourages you to spend more than you can afford, debt costs money, debt borrows from your future income, interest makes you pay more than the item cost, debt keeps you from reaching your financial goals, stress and serious medical problems, and debt can hurt your marriage. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. It was the last known missile fired by the United States in its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military called it a righteous strike, a drone attack after hours of surveillance on 29th of August against a vehicle that American officials thought contained an ISIS bomb and posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul Airport. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Matthew Akins, Christopher Cottle, Evan Hill, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled, New York Times Investigation in U.S. Drone Strike Evidence Suggests No ISIS Bomb. Stay with us for more. It was the last known missile fired by the United States in its 20-year war in Afghanistan, and the U.S. military called it a righteous strike, a drone attack after hours of surveillance on 29th of August against a vehicle that American officials thought contained an ISIS bomb and posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul airport. But a New York Times investigation of video evidence, along with interviews with more than a dozen of the driver's co-workers and family members in Kabul, raises serious doubts about the U.S. version of the events, including whether explosives were present in the vehicle, whether the driver had a connection to ISIS, and whether there was a second explosion after the missiles struck the car. Military officials said they did not know the identity of the car's driver when the drone fired, but deemed him suspicious because of how they interpreted his activities on that day, saying that he possibly visited an ISIF safe house and, at one point, loaded what they thought could be explosives into his car. The New York Times reporting has identified the driver as Zamari Ahmadi, a long-time worker for a U.S. aid group. The evidence suggests that his travels that day actually involved transporting colleagues to and from work, and an analysis of video feeds showed that what the military may have seen was Mr. Ahmadi and a colleague loading canisters of water into the trunk of his car to bring home to his family. While the U.S. military said the drone strike might have killed 3 Afghan civilians, New York Times reporting shows that it killed 10, including 7 Afghan children, in a dense residential block. Mr. Ahmadi, a 43-year-old, had worked since 2006 as an electrical engineer for Nutrition and Education International, a California-based aid group. The morning of the strike, Mr. Ahmadi's boss called from the office at around 8:45 a.m. and asked him to pick up his laptop. I asked him if he was still at home, and he said yes. The country director said in an interview at Nutrition and Education International's office in Kabul, Afghanistan. Like the rest of Mr. Ahmadi's colleagues, he spoke of condition of anonymity because of his association with an American company in Afghanistan. According to his relatives, that morning, Mr. Ahmadi left for work around 9 a.m. in a white 1996 Corolla that belonged to Nutrition and Education International, departing from his house, where he lived with his 3 brothers and their families, a few kilometers west of Kabul airport. U.S. officials told the New York Times that it was around this time that their target, a white sedan, first came under surveillance after it was spotted leaving a compound identified as an alleged ISIS safe house about 5 kilometers northwest of Kabul airport. It is unclear if officials were referring to one of the 3 stops that Mr. Ahmadi made to pick up 2 passengers and a laptop on his way to work. The latter location, the home of Nutrition and Education International's country director, was close to where a rocket attack claimed by ISIS would be launched against the airport the following morning from an improvised launcher concealed inside the trunk of a Toyota Corolla, a model similar to Mr. Ahmadi's vehicle. A New York Times reporter visited the director at his home and met with members of his family who said they had been living there for more than 40 years. "We have nothing to do with terrorism or ISIS," said the director, who also has a U.S. resettlement case. "We love America and we want to go there." Throughout the day, an MQ-9 Reaper drone continued to track Mr. Ahmadi's vehicle as it drove around Kabul, and U.S. officials claimed they intercepted communications between the sedan and the alleged ISIS safe house, instructing it to make several stops. But the people who rode with Mr. Ahmadi that day said that what the military, U.S. military, interpreted as a series of suspicious moves was in fact simply a normal day at work. After stopping to pick up breakfast, Mr. Ahmadi and his 2 passengers arrived at Nutrition and Education International's office, where security camera footage obtained by the New York Times recorded their arrival at 9:35 a.m. Later that morning, Mr. Ahmadi drove some co-workers to a Taliban-occupied police station downtown, where they said they requested permission to distribute food to refugees in a nearby park. Mr. Ahmadi and his three passengers returned to the office around 2 p.m. As seen on camera footage, Mr. Ahmadi came out a half hour later with a hose that was streaming water. With the help of a security guard, he filled several empty plastic containers with water. According to his co-workers, water deliveries had stopped in his neighborhood after the collapse of the Afghan government, and Mr. Ahmadi had been bringing home water from the office. "I filled the containers myself and helped him load them into the trunk of his car," the security guard said. At 3:38 p.m., the security guard and another co-worker moved the car further into the driveway. The camera footage ends soon after, when the office shut off its generator at the end of the workday and Mr. Ahmadi and three passengers left for home. Around this time, U.S. officials said that the drone had tracked Mr. Ahmadi to a compound 8 to 12 kilometers southwest of Kabul Airport, a location that matched Nutrition and Education International's office. There, they said the drone observed Mr. Ahmadi and three others loading heavy packages into the car, which they believed might contain explosives. But the passengers said that they had only two laptops with them, which they put inside the vehicle, and that the trunk of the car had no other cargo than the plastic water-filled containers that were placed there earlier. In separate interviews, all three passengers denied loading explosives into the vehicle they were about to commute home in. According to one of Mr. Ahmadi's passengers, a colleague who regularly commuted with him, the ride home was filled with their usual laughing and banter, but with one difference. Mr. Ahmadi kept the radio silent as he was afraid of getting in trouble with the Taliban. "He liked cheerful music," the colleague said. "That day we couldn't play any music in the car." Mr. Ahmadi dropped off his three passengers and then headed for his home near Kabul Airport. "I asked him to come in for a bit, but he said he was tired," the last passenger said. Although U.S. officials said that at that point they still knew little about Mr. Ahmadi's identity, they had become convinced that the white sedan he was driving posed an imminent threat to U.S. troops at Kabul Airport. When Mr. Ahmadi pulled into the courtyard of his home, which officials said was different than the alleged ISIS safe house, the tactical commander made the decision to strike the vehicle, launching a Hellfire missile at around 4:50 p.m. Although the target was now inside the densely populated residential area, the drone operator quickly scanned and saw only a single adult male greeting the vehicle, and therefore assessed with reasonable certainty that no women, no children, or non-combatants would be killed, according to U.S. officials. But according to Mr. Ahmadi's relatives, as Mr. Ahmadi pulled into his courtyard, several of his children and his brother's children came out, excited to see him, and sat in the car as he backed it inside. Mr. Ahmadi's brother, Romal, was sitting on the ground floor and his wife when he heard the sound of the gate opening and Mr. Ahmadi's car entering. His adult cousin, Nasser, had gone to fetch water for his ablutions and greeted him. The car's engine was still running when there was a sudden blast and the room was sprayed with shattered glass from the window, Romal recalled. He staggered to his feet. "Where are the children?" he asked his wife. "They're outside," she replied. Romal ran out into the courtyard. He saw that his nephew, Faisal, a 16-year-old teenager, had fallen from the exterior staircase, his torso and head grievously wounded by shrapnel. He wasn't breathing. Amid the smoke and fire, he saw another dead nephew before neighbors arrived and pulled him away, he said. Since the strike, U.S. military officials justified their actions by citing an even larger blast that took place afterwards. Because there were secondary explosions, there is reasonable conclusion to be made that there was explosives within the vehicle, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said last week. But an examination of the scene of the strike, conducted by the New York Times visual investigation team and a New York Times reporter the morning afterwards, and followed up with a second visit 4 days later, found no evidence of a second, more powerful explosion. Experts who examined photographs and videos pointed out that although there was clear evidence of a missile strike and subsequent vehicle fire, there were no collapsed or blown-out walls, no destroyed vegetation, and only one dent in the entrance gate indicating a single shockwave. It seriously questions the credibility of the intelligence or technology utilized to determine this was a legitimate target, said Chris Cobb-Smith, a British Army veteran and security consultant. While the U.S. military has so far acknowledged only 3 Afghan civilian casualties, Mr. Ahmadi's relative said that 10 members of their family, including 7 children, were killed in the U.S. strike. Mr. Ahmadi, the 3 of his children, Zamir, 20 years old, Faisal, 16-year-old, and Farzad, 10 years old, Mr. Ahmadi's cousin, Nasser, 30-year-old, 3 of Ramal's children, Arwin, 7 years old, Benjamin, 6 years old, and Hayat, 2-year-old, and 2 3-year-old girls, Malikeh and Somayeh. Neighbors and an Afghan health official confirmed that bodies of children were removed from the site. They said the blast had shredded most of the victims. Family members questioned why Mr. Ahmadi would have a motivation to attack American troops when he had already applied for refugee settlement in the United States. His adult cousin Nasser, a former U.S. military contractor, had also applied for resettlement in the United States. He had planned to marry his fiancée, Samia, last Friday so that she could be included in his immigration case. All of them were innocent, said Emal, Mr. Ahmadi's brother. You say he was an ISIS member, but he actually worked for the Americans.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If there was no Battle of Karbala, we would be oblivious to Islam's principles today. May 2nd, 2008. If this battle had not taken place in Karbala, we would not be aware of the principles of Islam to the extent we are today, and there was probably just a nominal trace of Islam. Not only were this great event and the holy blood of the martyrs not undermined, but they also gained more prominence in the history. This is an outstanding example. Sayyida Zainab, Sukaina, and the innocent girls and women recognized the magnitude of Ashura. May 2, 2008. Everyone was wondering what had happened on the day of Ashura. The greatness of the event, the greatness of the jihad done by the Prophet's loved ones and his companions was not known to anyone. Neither was the magnitude of the catastrophe in which the Holy Prophet's sons and loved ones were martyred. The majority of those who were present in that battle did not recognize the importance of this issue, and those who were fighting for the enemies were so ignorant and unaware that they did not realize what had happened. Those enchanted by arrogance, lust, and animal urges cannot understand what is happening in the human world. Of course, Sayyida Zainab, Sukaina, and those innocent girls and women did recognize the magnitude of the event. This is what happened on the day of Ashura.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana latsham.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Events of Ashura live on due to Zainab and Imam Sajjad, peace be upon them. September 20th, 1989. If Zainab al-Kubra and Imam Sajjad had not fought or revealed and interpreted the truth of Ashura's philosophy or the purpose of Hussein ibn Ali and the enemy's oppression during the days of captivity in the evening of Ashura in Karbala, in the following days en route to Sham and Kufa, and in the city of Sham, then on the pilgrimage of Karbala, and while moving to Medina and during the many years that these great figures lived, the event of Ashura wouldn't have survived and remained as vivacious till this day.
The visit of Qatar's foreign minister is the latest in a series of visits undertaken by foreign dignitaries to Pakistan in recent days. Following the visits of foreign ministers of Germany, Italy, UK and Netherlands, the visit of Qatar's top diplomat also focused on Afghanistan. His visit comes just days after the Afghan Taliban announced an interim government that drew criticism from certain Western countries for ignoring the demands of inclusive setup. Speaking at a joint news conference, Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi said the immediate priority must be the well-being of the people of Afghanistan.
And the most important thing that we both agree to is that we have to protect the interests of the people of Afghanistan. And for that, their safety, their security, stability, and to ensure that this Afghanistan, you know, does not become an arena for, you know, for proxy wars.
Since the Taliban took over, there have been fears of economic meltdown as the international financial institutions and Western countries suspended the assistance.
Humanitarian situation and the humanitarian assistance should be independent from any political progress, because we believe that the Afghan people deserve to be helped, deserve to be supported, despite what's happening in the political landscape.
The Qatari foreign minister said the inclusive government is important for the unity of Afghanistan. The interim government announced by the Taliban was contrary to the commitment they made earlier that the political dispensation would be inclusive and broad-based. The interim government is set to take oath on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 attacks in the United States. Many countries are closely watching the Taliban whether they live up to the promises. But Pakistan and Qatar maintain that the world community should not take any steps that may aggravate the problems for the people of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Palestinians organized several rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where tensions mounted as Israeli regime began to practice a brutal crackdown on Palestinian prisoners and transfer them to new facilities. Palestinian inmates set fire to cells protesting the Israeli violent measures against them that have doubled after six Palestinian inmates escaped Jalbu prison early this week.
Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails have been facing a war crime, especially after the heroic escape by six Palestinian inmates from Jalbu prison. Israel has adopted violent measures against Palestinian detainees, including solitary confinement.
Palestinian resistance factions called prisoners to resist these attempts to transfer them to various facilities, describing the condition in Israeli jails as war crime that requires urgent move to protect the Palestinian detainees. Palestinian Prisoners Club warned that tension would escalate between Palestinian detainees and the Israeli regime over the relocating of some detainees from the Islamic Jihad movement, as most of the six inmates are affiliated with the group.
The Palestinian resistance has a clear message that any Israeli attack threatening the lives of the prisoners will lead to serious consequences, and the Israeli regime will pay a heavy price for any violation. Our Palestinian resistance is ready to defend our detainees. Also, it's a national Palestinian duty to provide safety for the six heroes who have escaped the Israeli prison.
Palestinians called the international community and human rights groups to make serious actions in order to protect the Palestinian detainees from the Israeli violence.
We hope that all Palestinian detainees will be free soon. We are here to support our inmates. We won't remain silent amid the international community's apathy towards the issue. We will raise our voices against the international conventions that are only written on paper with no practical results.
Six Palestinian inmates escaped from the high-security Jalbu prison in northern parts of the occupied territories on Monday, prompting a massive manhunt by Israeli army. Along with its manhunt for six Palestinian detainees, the Israeli army has practiced violent measures against detainees inside jails. Palestinians here say they can't remain silent as the prisoners' issue is among their top priorities. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The British government has come under renewed condemnation after failing to honour their pledge to define Islamophobia 2 years after making the initial promise. with MPs and critics all condemning the lack of action amid rising Islamophobia across the UK. An all-party parliamentary group on British Muslims created their own definition of Islamophobia in 2018, describing it as a form of racism.
Islamophobia is rooted in racism and is a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness or perceived Muslimness.
Regardless which political group makes the definition, grassroots British Muslim groups are concerned over what they see as an establishment-pushed definition.
The best case scenario for this definition of Islamophobia would be one that forces the government to critically self-reflect and critically analyse its policies and policies of previous governments that have led to Islamophobia. I do specifically mean the so-called counter-extremism policies, which have just been a thinly veiled excuse to surveil the Muslim community. And these policies have had such detrimental impacts on the mental and physical well-being of the Muslim community. It's so likely we're going to have a watered-down definition that is nothing more than empty words. Why? Because there's been no engagement with the grassroots of society. There's been no engagement with organisations like ours, like MPAC UK, or CAGE, or MEND, or, critically, active massages like Lewisham Islamic Centre. There's been no engagement with organisations like these, which have had to deal with the mess created by 20 years of suspicion and policies and institutionalised Islamophobia.
Some have already begun to adopt the definition, including the opposition Labour Party. However, accusations of Islamophobia within Labour remain, despite its implementation.
A lot of scepticism still surrounds this definition, with many fearing that it will ultimately fail to serve the community effectively, if at all. However, while MPs continue to procrastinate on the issue, Islamophobia remains a very real and persistent threat on both a street and systemic level. Robert Carter, London.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Dar'a city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
Today, Dar al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents, as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Dar al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Dar al-Balad, southern Syria.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people.